This is writer and game designer Robin D. Laws.
And this is game designer and writer Kenneth Height.
And this is our podcast, Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff.
Bandwidth brought to you by Pelgrane Press.
Stuff we're here to talk about in this episode include...
A Death Touch campaign.
A Bulgarian spy ring.
Cutting your overlong manuscript.
And Douglas MacArthur shamanism.
Well, I sure am glad President Cat greenlit the Catstronauts' mission to expand the International Space Station. I hear he signed the authorization by swatting a pen across the floor. True leadership right there.
Giant laser pointers in space? What's not to like? And even better, the space station has live stream cameras. Although, half the time it's just nose boops. Let's check how the Catstronauts are doing up there on the space station.
Oh man, there goes Waffles the pilot. He's off to see how many kibble bits can achieve orbit around his belly. A pioneer in snackodynamics, that cat.
Here comes the kitty technician, Blanket. Careful, Waffles. If he catches you clogging the air filters with crumbs again, then it's back to litter box duty for you.
Wait a second, Robin. Major Meowser just got a hair-raising transmission from HQ. Is that the new napping module on its way?
Yep, it's their first space station edition. Science Officer Pom Pom better know what to do, or there'll be a... catastrophe in 3, 2, 1.
Here she is, and she's sharpening her claws on the instruction manual. Well, it might accidentally flip to the right page with enough swiping, I guess.
Look at them working together. Waffles is keeping the station steady with his prodigious belly. Blanket is swatting at the module's fasteners like a feather toy. Pom Pom finally found the right instructions, and Major Meowser is, napping on them? Teamwork, by golly!
Hooray for the Catstronauts!
The space station is saved!
Until the next module arrives and starts another near catastrophe, that is.
Wow, managing your own space station with a crew of feline heroes. Now that's the life!
You know you can, Robin. The official Catstronauts board game is available now from Atlas Games. It's full of pawsome color art by the comic book's creator, Drew Brockington, and Catstronauts features cooperative play that's fun for all ages. Find out more at atlas-games.com/catstronauts.
Sounds like the Catstronauts board game is perfect for the whole family. Let's meet this stellar challenge by picking up the Catstronauts board game now!
The rattle of dice, the thump of miniatures, the crunch of Doritos. Hold on. Those are all the same noises. They're someone being beaten up in a Golden Harvest Hong Kong picture. We just have the sound up real loud because it's getting us all excited down here in the gaming hut. We can't even hear Peter Frampton coming alive because we're so riveted to the chop and slash and hit and thud on screen because beloved Patreon backer Ben A has asked us how we would run a shortish 9-session scenario set in New York City's Chinatown in July, August, 1973, tracking down the Death Touch master who murdered Bruce Lee. Robin, there's way more to unpack in all of this, maybe, than a mere segment can contain, but we'll try,
yes.
Much like a Golden Harvest film, to get all the fights in, at least.
Yes, turned out the theme of this episode was too many cool facts in each segment. So Ben started by asking which system you should use, and I think that depends on what kind of style you want. If you want as Hong Kong would have done it from the mid-80s onward, Feng Shui is the obvious choice.
Right.
That's going to be big, crazy action and not realistic martial arts and not the sort of style of martial arts film that Bruce Lee was in, really. So perhaps Knight's Black Agents would give you the combination of investigation with a little bit more combat that would get you where you want to go.
If you're using Knight's Black Agents, you can add the martial arts zoom from Ken Writes About Stuff, and that will let you focus in. You'll just have to write up the special rules for Jeet Kune Do and the other rival forms of kung fu that are around in America in the 70s.
Right. And it depends on how far you want to depart from the story to actually have a lot of martial arts fighting in it, because at least according to the NYPD, this is a story of fighting by shooting each other with guns.
Yes.
There's some ornamental nunchucks that get into the story later.
What's the Western martial arts?
So one thing that I would want to do, especially if we've got nine sessions is that I would want to deal with the death of Bruce Lee as a mythological event, meaning that as soon as he died, people started attaching stories to him. He's becomes an even larger than life figure now that he's no longer in life. And I would also want to recognize that over the years, some incredibly disrespectful things have been done to his memory with the understandable impact on his family. So I'd like to sort of not totally fun ruin it, but find a way to make it fun while also being respectful to a great action star and a political activist who does not deserve to be, you know, rendered entirely foolish by, you know, having the Dim Mak story be real. But you got to have the Dim Mak story in it. So first of all, Ken, the unfortunate reality of his demise at 33.
Yeah, he dies at age 33, as you say, in July 20th, 1973. He's in Hong Kong, dies of a cerebral edema, meaning that his brain fluid has swole up and killed him. It probably was caused either by undiagnosed epilepsy or possibly heat stroke, because he'd had his sweat glands removed, and that is not good for your heat stroke, or possibly hyponatremia, which is basically you're not getting enough sodium, you're not getting enough electrolytes, and that, of course, is also something that happens during a really hot day in Hong Kong. So hot day in Hong Kong may have brought on all of this. The diagnosis was that he died from an overdose of Equagesic, which is a combination aspirin and sedative, but he'd taken that for his whole career and nothing had ever happened, so that doesn't seem super likely. He had collapsed with a cerebral edema earlier on May 10th, also in Hong Kong, while he was doing ADR for Enter the Dragon. So he was in Hong Kong, he was getting ready for his next movie, he was finishing up, he was shooting a current movie, and he was meeting that night, he was supposed to meet George Lazenby to be in his third movie, and that, of course, never happened. And you mentioned that we have the legend of Dim Mak, and I feel like this gives us sort of the in where somewhere in New York Chinatown, there is a guy who's saying in various nightclubs and whatnot that he either knows the guy or was the guy who used Dim Mak to kill Bruce Lee. So you're killing the guy who's spreading this rumor. And then maybe one of the questions you're going to solve during the campaign is, does this guy actually have the Dim Mak, or is he just running his mouth? What's going on? Because
right. So it's satisfying to get the guy who's telling this stupid story.
The stupid Bruce story.
Lee. So that squares the story.
Even as you say, even right after his death, legends blew up that it was the triads that had killed him, or maybe Shaolin masters who were angered that he was teaching kung fu to Americans. And even in his lifetime, Bruce Lee contributed to this mythology, saying that he'd had his famous 1964 fight with Wong Jok Man over the question of should he be allowed to teach kung fu to Americans. Wong, of course, said, "I teach kung fu to Americans. What are you on about?" And Wong and Bruce had a difference of opinion as to who won the fight. Wong challenged him to a rematch in public. Bruce never took him up on it. So question mark, question mark, question mark. Other possibilities are that he hadn't paid triad protection on the sets of his movies in Hong Kong, or that way back in 1959, he got in a fight with a triad leader's son, and that's why he had to move to Seattle. And so all of these bits of his biography get sort of jumbled in to create the version of this legend, that either it's the triads or the Shaolin masters, or I suppose a Shaolin triad of some sort that is out to get him for reasons of the past.
Right. And because his death is so tragic and disappointing, it's not surprising that people try to attach, you know, some sort of meaning to it.
Right. Yeah. It's similar to the conspiracy theories, you know, around, you know, Kennedy or whoever, that, you know, they get shot and it doesn't seem fair that it's just some random brain edema or communist that did it. And so you have to make up, you know, a story that makes you feel like it's an appropriately legendary ending.
Right. So our guy who's claiming to have used Dim Mak probably knows something about it. What would he know about Dim Mak that he would tell the player characters?
Dim Mak was allegedly, it's the death touch, and you strike someone, and depending on how good you are at ki manipulation, you're able to either set a timer that will kill them later or kill them instantly or kill them an hour from now, whatever. And so it was allegedly invented by Zhang San Feng. He lived in Kublai Khan's time, probably. If he'd lived at all, if he's not a complete legend, he's the inventor of Tai Chi, again, in legend. Fun ruiners have said I'm pretty sure Tai Chi goes back before the Mongols, but whatever. But the notion is that it's sort of combat acupressure. So you can spot the key meridians and you strike at a proper key meridian, and then that sets up the death. And you don't have to strike that hard because it's all about knowing the place. So in theory, you can, you know, poke them with your finger and the dim mock will take you, or just touch them with your palm and the dim mock will happen. And that's the legend of the dim mock.
Right. So when the player characters arrive in Chinatown in 1973, they're going to find a complicated scene of street gangs that have more venerable tongs behind them. And in one case, there's one tong that has two different gangs that it switches in midstream. So let's lay out the criminal political territory with the various gangs, starting with the Flying Dragons.
Yeah, the Flying Dragons go first because their patron tong, the Hip Sing, are the biggest tong in New York and also the biggest tong in America. Tong just means club, but it has connotations of sort of an ethnic protection society. So,
right. I guess we should go backwards a bit and talk about the Hip Sing. So they go all the way back to the turn of the century Tong Wars, and they blend to various degrees at various times organized crime with being a protective fraternal organization, which Chinese people absolutely needed in New York at that time. And so sometimes they're run by out and out gangsters. Other times the fraternal organization sort of comes to the fore. We could do another three segments on them. They were involved with the Kuomintang, therefore with drug smuggling. And then because of that connection, they worked with the CIA for a while earlier than our period here. And in the 70s, it's back to emphasizing the fraternal side outwardly. And so that gives room for them to need street operatives to do the more crimey part of what they're up to. And that's where the Flying Dragons come in.
Right. And the Flying Dragons, or Fei Lung, are led by a gangster named Michael the Scientist Chen. And they are what are called hatchet men, is the official name in Chinese for the Hip Sings. The Hip Sings, as you say, are headed by the now outwardly respectable Benny Uncle Seven Ong, known as the mayor of Chinatown. He sort of benevolently guides Chinatown, or tries to. Other rivals of the Hip Sing include their rival Tong Vian Long, but also include the Chinese American social services people who are trying to get Chinese Americans who are flooding in as communist China continues to be terrible into New York social services instead of depending on the Hip Sing or the On Long for their assimilation and their money and their way of life in New York. And so there is a weird rivalry going on as well with the sort of younger Chinese Americans who are all totally assimilated or mostly assimilated and are trying to sort of break the power of the Tongs in a political way, which is wild. But I don't know if you want social workers in your Golden Harvest film or not, but if you need one to show up, here's where they come from. As I mentioned, their rival Tong is the On Long, and the On Long are headed by a guy named Wing Yung Chan, or I believe they are. It's very, very hard to track down the On Long membership, at least at this late remove, but he's in the right era.
Yeah, they weren't necessarily admitting it, and there'd be varying newspaper reports right. As to who was in charge.
And one of their co-heads apparently was from the On Long in Pittsburgh. They all got indicted in Chicago, proud to say, for RICO. And at that point, you know, whoever is identified as the head of the On Long is whoever they can make RICO charges stick to. It's not necessarily who is the real head. But anyway, Wing Yung Chan is as good a name as any, and I suppose the real head of the On Long is not going to be mad at us now. And they have gangs affiliated with them, among them the White Eagles, which is the first of the Chinese youth gangs in Chinatown, the Bak Ching. They're headed by Paul Ma.
And he has a great movie moment that you've got to fit in at some point. He shows up to an arraignment with his jacket open so that everybody can see the silk shirt he's wearing, which is full of bullet holes. So you can't not have that in there somehow. Presumably, he shows that shirt off in numerous different occasions.
Right. And the other gang that's affiliated with the On Long is the Ghost Shadows, the Guaying, and they're led by Nei Wong, who wildly gets his start trying to knock over On Long casinos, or gambling houses, I guess, technically, in Boston, and then for some reason becomes suddenly a soldier in Boston for the On Long, and then he's moved to New York in this era to sort of pick up the remnants of the Ghost Shadows. And the Ghost Shadows, of course, as all good Chinatown gangs, they say they're the first And they go all the way back to the 1890s, and a thin layer of continuity has led down to now. So if you want any of this to be true, you certainly can say it, and you're not going to be unrealistic in terms of what people were saying about their own gang at the time.
Right. The White Eagles are the gang that give us our Bruce Lee connection, because they're recent arrivals from Hong Kong, and they arrive, and all of a sudden, the Chinese Americans who speak good English start pushing them around, so they get together, they form a gang, and they're also being pushed around by Latino and Black gangs. But then Bruce Lee becomes a star, and all of a sudden, they pick up some nunchucks, and they acquire his swagger, and that suddenly makes other rival gangs afraid of them, and they, you know, bask in his stardom, and they have a 6-foot White Eagle statue on top of the tenement where they hang out. And if you need a premise for one of your adventures, they make their money by kidnapping the daughters of local wealthy merchants. So you could, as player characters, pick up an ally by rescuing someone from the White Eagles.
And not that we need more stuff in these 9 sessions, but by this time in 73, the White Eagles have fissioned into the more complacent White Eagles who are trying to, you know, go along to get along, work with the On Long, etc., and the more radical offshoot, the Black Eagles, who don't want to put up with any of this and just want to be baller, man. And whether or not they're real rivals or whether it's kayfabe, so that the Black Eagles can go outrage the elders and the White Eagles can say, oh my God, we hate those guys, but still sharing the profits, also unknown at this time.
Right. But someone offends the elders enough that the On Long switches to the Ghost Shadows, and they sanction Nikki, the next leader of the Ghost Shadows, and his henchman, Philip Halfbreed Hand, to attack the Eagle Hangout with machine guns, thereby giving him, one of his nicknames is Onion Head. He shows up like as a 13-year-old. And then a little later, he becomes Machine Gun Johnny as well as Onion Head. And we'll get to the end of his story once we move past the period.
And in a fun fact, the Ghost Shadows have an enforcer named Applehead. So you have Onion Head and Applehead on opposite sides. It's beautiful.
Obviously, those are polar opposites.
Right.
Apples and onions never get along.
Hated enemies. So the reason that Nikki moves up is that in April of 74, which is too late for our era, but maybe you could move it ahead just for fun, is that an ex-Hong Kong cop named Kai Hong Mak, who got beaten up by Nay Wong and some Ghost Shadows, takes his revenge showing up at the Fido, the Mayflower nightclub. He's been tipped off as to what table Nay Wong is at, and he guns Nay Wong down in the nightclub along with Wong's girlfriend, Debbie. The papers at that time say that Debbie was Kai Hong Mak's ex or current betrothed. That does not seem to be true either, but it is, you know, was good enough to get in the Village Voice. And so surely it's good enough to add to your campaign if you want a murderous love triangle along with everything else you've got going on.
Yeah, well, 74, that's close enough. We've got 9 episodes. We can do that. That also means that if the players need to find Nikki, he famously just paces Mott Street in Chinatown at night waiting for enemies to show up. So that's an easy way for the player characters to go and find him without having to
getting ready to throw down
bodyguards and stuff.
Yeah. So the situation, as I think we've painted, is full of cinematic possibility and full of story possibility. And so I suppose we should do a little bit of for 9 sessions. That's like 3 adventures. So there's going to be, you know, you hear about the guy is ensconced in one of these gangs. You have to use the gang's enemy gang to get at him. And then undercover of this Yojimbo moment, you slip in and take down the alleged Dim Mock Master. Is that basically the structure that you see, Robin?
Yeah, I think so. And that way you can sort of have everybody that in order to get the favors they need to find the guy, they have to, you know, do favor for one side, and then they get embroiled and have to do the other side. And then, of course, another faction, you know, as in the Tong Wars in the 1900s, in the 70s, cops in New York are still plenty corrupt. So you have to deal with them as well. And that you can bring that in. And I think essentially, you know, everybody sort of has a rumor about this guy. And then, you know, finally, when you get him, you may, depending on what reality level you're going for, maybe he is beginning. His key has been knocked out of whack by making these false claims, and his energies are damaged, and, you know, the Dim Mak is beginning to work on him. And you could do that classic Hong Kong thing of it's all been naturalistic up until now, and then there's a big flying people fight at the end as he begins to manifest his powers, and maybe so do you, depending on what different things you've done, learning the byways of the Chinatown crime scene in 73, 74. You could extend it even further, because Johnny Onionhead Cheng's story is only just beginning. He winds up killing Michael the Scientist Chen. He has the sanction of Cheng's godfather, Benny Ong, and he takes over. And the reason the dispute there is happening is because he wants to get into heroin smuggling instead of just, you know, street crime in New York. And he indeed becomes a major heroin smuggler. He's able to take over from the mafia after they are knocked out in the 80s. And he's busted in 1992. And if you want to read more about the Ghost Shadows, a high-ranking member named Peter Chin has written a memoir that has just come out in 2025 called In the Ghost Shadows. So there's lots more research that you could get into about this whole period.
It is where many of the details from this very segment have come.
Well, having had a very detailed segment, I'm sure there'll be no details required in whatever waits for us on the other side of this exciting commercial message.
Moving drama.
Hilarious comedy.
And you are the sole protagonist.
Page Turners is my game of personal storytelling for one player and one GM.
Coming soon from Pelgrane Press.
Longtime listeners know Hillfolk, my game of dramatic group play.
Winner of the coveted Diana Jones Award.
Page Turners shifts its dynamic down to the intimate scale of a single main character whose fiction you weave on the fly with one other creator.
Shockingly simple rules keep the focus on emotional interaction.
Extensive guidance helps you shape satisfying outcomes.
Writers Sarah Sam Saltiel, Wade Rocket, and Ruth Tillman join Robin in presenting 11 scenarios spanning a wealth of genres and tones.
Scenarios include
Jazz Age Ambition and Glamour,
A Childhood Haunted by Strife and a Shadowy Being,
Deceit and Survival on the Spaceship Earth Again,
A Stay in Bath takes an unexpected turn in the Austin-inspired Entreaty and Entanglement,
The Screwball 30s Hijinks of Loose Screws,
The Shakespearean Comedy of Love's Loyal Laborers,
A Love Triangle Unfolding from the Turbulent 60s to the Troubled 20-teens,
Behind the Music Drama in the L.A. Punk Scene,
The Arrival of a Telepathic Stranger on a Spacebound Way Station,
Tragic Love Between a Vampire and a Mortal,
and an epic multi-generational saga of artificial beings attempting to build a civilization in the tradition of that extinct species, Homo sapiens.
Gorgeously laid out and illustrated by graphic superstar Jen McCleary.
Whoever you want to be, wherever your imagination takes you,
whether your journey leads to Union Doom or something harder to define,
Page Turners unleashes your story in new and unexpected ways.
The retinal scan you had to undergo, not to mention the extensive background check, tell us we're once more in the Tradecraft Hut. And this time around, beloved Patreon backer Phil Masters would like to know about a bunch of Bulgarians recently convicted of spying for Russia in London. He correctly says it's a fine mixture of the shambolic and the sinister. And it turns out, Ken, that this is not only that, but it's a sequel.
Yeah, because these Bulgarians were run at a remove by Jan Marsalek, our featured villain from episode 671. And the story in this case is from The Guardian, which, speaking of shambolic, you have to sort of piece it together from a lot of other press releases to get anything like a connected narrative out of it. But I believe we have so pieced. So Marsalek, in 2015, when he's still at Wirecard, before he flees to Russia, has recruited a Bulgarian SIGINT specialist private eye type shady guy named Orlan Rusov. Rusov is a Bulgarian, and he has recruited him to steal a secure Chinese mobile phone. This is just straight up corporate espionage, but he's still in his Rolodex, took his Rolodex with him to Russia. And so on the 14th of December, 2020, he texts Rusov and says, all right, we have a new enemy. He's your fellow Bulgarian. So it should be, you know, like money for jam to get him.
Yes. You know, the ways of Bulgarians.
Exactly. Being one yourself. And this is a Bellingcat journalist named Christo Grozev. And I think we mentioned some of this back in 671 as well. but the details have just come out because the trial has just concluded, and that is where we are today. So Rusev finds a villa in Bulgaria that Grozev is attached to, and then someone at the villa says, oh, he's never here. This is just a vacation villa. He has an apartment in Vienna, and so they go to the apartment in Vienna, and this is in August of 2021, and his apartment is like, oh, no, that's his dad's apartment. His house is out of town. So finally, he finds the guy. He then pays a contact at an airline to find Grozev's travel plans, and that's the smartest thing that Rusev does in this whole operation, is pay some guy at a Swiss airline to tell him when this guy gets on a plane. And those travel plans include a Bellingcat conference in Valencia in September of 2021. By this time, Rusev has recruited another Bulgarian, a guy named Bizer Jambanov, who's given himself the nicknames of Mad Max and Von Damme.
In case you're wondering whether this guy's a loose cannon.
Right. Never give yourself a self nickname. And so Jambanov tasks his girlfriend, Katrine Ivanova, who he's living with, by the way, not some random girlfriend, it's his proper girlfriend, to spy on Grozev's house in Vienna.
Right. And he's called Rusev Jackie Chan. There's no word on record as to whether he likes that nickname or not.
Right. Well, it's probably on record, and we'll get to why all of this is on record, and we know they're fun nicknames for each other in the rousing conclusion. Ivanova, meanwhile, in trial, said she knew nothing about any spying. She'd been told that Grozev was a corrupt journalist, and she was going to help expose his relationship with an arms dealer, and that her boyfriend was just public-spirited and doing this, or was maybe hired as a private detective, because he was a private detective.
Right. And he also told people, I think, including both of his girlfriends, spoiler, that he was in Interpol.
Yes, he told, well, I know that he told the other girlfriend, his side piece, Vanya Gabarova, because he took her to Valencia instead of his proper girlfriend, and he had her surveil Grozev, and he told Gabarova that he was from Interpol, and in trial, Gabarova said she'd always dreamed of being a cop, and she thought that was more exciting than her actual job of as being a medical courier. And anyway, he said he's doing a criminal investigation of Grozev. And so she friends Grozev on Facebook to keep track of him. He friends her back, and Rusev is very excited, and he thinks she would make a great honey trap. And Jambanov is saying, I don't think she's the honey trap type. Maybe because he was like, then she'd have to be with somebody besides me. And Marzalek.
Well, also the honey trap thing is very old school.
Right. It's
the first thing they teach.
And Marzalek is saying, well, we've had a lot of honey traps, and then they fall in love with the target. And that's not a good method. And Rusev is saying, you don't know her. She won't fall in love with anyone. She's cold, which is an awful thing for someone to say, even on a text message to spies.
Right. And there's some hilarious love triangle stuff that Jambanov gets up to. He tells both of his girlfriends that he has brain cancer, which explains why he's away from each of them half the time. Uh-huh. He's busy off being treated for brain cancer. Gabarova eventually gets suspicious, so he FaceTimes her with a toilet paper bandages wrapped around his head, and there's a screen grab of that, because I think she hit screen grab. I'm not sure how thoroughly she was buying that. Ivanova, for her part, thinks she's in an open relationship and has another boyfriend, but... And the rules of that are that Jambanov is supposed to also inform her of his doings, which he's not doing. So she...
Well, if you can't trust a Bulgarian subcontractor for the Russian spy services nicknamed Mad Max, who can you trust? This world.
Exactly.
It's so broken. So anyway, Jambanov and Gabarova recruit her ex, an artist, or at least a painter named Tichomir Ivanchev, also Bulgarian. They give him the Interpol story and set him to watching the Vienna house. Ivanova, meanwhile, has been following a different Russian expat journalist named Roman Dobrokhtov. He runs The Insider, which is where our big Wirecard story mostly came from previously.
Right. Hence the grudge.
Right. At least on one trip from Budapest to Berlin in November of 2021, there was a plan to maybe kidnap Dobrokhtov to sort of make the Russian spy services look better after the sort of disaster that was the Skirpal and Navalny cases. So Ivanova also follows Grozev to Montenegro in June of 2022, wearing surveillance glasses, and this would be like a Google Glass or whatnot. But she also makes sure to take pictures on her phone. So to, you know, better safe than sorry, I guess.
Yeah, they're easier to upload that way.
Grozev is meeting a guy named Kirill Kachur, who is a former Kremlin investigator who is now in exile because he Kremlin investigated too much. And Rusev put a second team on Kachur, but they weren't tried, so we don't know as much about them. Also in November 2021, another of Rusev's minions, which is what he calls them in his phone, an MMA fighter named Ivan the Destroyer Stoyanov. This is the guy, you get the idea, his nickname maybe came from somebody else, surveilled a former Kazakh politico named Bergey Ryskalyev. And this is, again, on the orders from Marsalek. They plotted but did not carry out a fake protest attack on the Kazakh embassy that the team would then pin on Ryskalyev, and that would help drive Kazakhstan closer to Moscow. This is after the invasion of Ukraine, and Kazakhstan is saying, oh, this is a Russia problem, not a Russia and Kazakhstan problem. You do your best, buddies. And they were trying to fix that. And of course, they never got around to it because they were also busy reconnoitering a U.S. military base at Stuttgart. And this is Ivanova and Jambanov. And they went and they walked around it and filmed the whole base. And their plan was that they would come back with a car that had been fitted with a Razor 2, which is a device that apparently he had three of in his, what he called his Indiana Jones garage. What it does is it grabs the international mobile subscriber identity, the IMSI, from phones. It's what your SIM, I guess, attaches to. And then the idea being you get the IMSI number of all the Ukrainians who are on the base being trained to run the Patriot air defense. And so when the Russians find that group of IMSI numbers with signals intelligence, they can assume that that group is at a Patriot battery and can attack that battery with missiles. So great plan, except they never got around to doing it for some reason, possibly because they were on a monthly, not a per turnover thing. But anyway, while they're dinking around with this plan, outfitting the car and whatnot, they found a used car to buy that wouldn't be connected to them. But it's not even MI5 that brings them down, Robin. They're brought down by the Scotland Yard, by the Metropolitan Police. The counterterrorism unit arrests Rusev on February 8th, 2023. He lives in a former hotel in Great Yarmouth, big maze of rooms full of computer equipment. He's got his Indiana Jones garage full of more computer equipment. And among the computer equipment are encrypted hard drive backups that he left open, so you could just type in, you know, whatever and get to it. He hadn't deleted any of his backups, and he hadn't deleted his phone, which still had all 78,000 Telegram messages laying out this whole ordeal, which is how we know so much about it.
Right. So when people ask, how do gumshoe investigative abilities get information reliably so easily? It's because it's actually realistic for people to be extremely sloppy with all of this high security stuff. And so you can entirely justify the dumbness of spies, which is not new, if you just know a bit about espionage history.
Right. The whole ring cost the Russians around £210,000. That at least is what the top level payout was to Rusev. And then, you know, going down, you know, it got paid to the other people. So maybe, you know, adding in cost of goods and everything else, not even £500,000, which is, you know, it would have been cheap at the price if they'd actually accomplished anything, which they apparently did not. Rusev, Jambanov, and Stoyanov all pled guilty before trial. They've got around 10 years apiece. Ivanova, Gabarova, and Ivanchev are found guilty at the trial in May of 2025.
Yes, I thought I was working for Interpol. Defense did not help.
It did not seem to work well enough. So keep that in mind, everyone. If your Bulgarian boyfriend says he's got an Interpol job for you, maybe double check that. But yeah, the whole thing, as you say, is sort of a clown show. And it's wild that this is what they're spending all their time on, while meanwhile, you know, the government is not prosecuting open and shut cases of Chinese spies bribing parliament, but whatever. It's still fun to make fun of the Russians, regardless of whether they're the real threat anymore in Britain or not. And it is, as you say, probably the best look at the actual shambolic functions of what are generally called a network when you're talking about it in the sort of abstract. And what this would be is the real spy master, in this case, Marsalek or Marsalek's handler, has a guy, and this guy's job is to set up a network. And Marsalek, in theory, should know very little about it. But of course, as we've seen, Rusev is a compulsive texter and a sort of a vainglorious goof in general.
Right. So it's easy to imagine vampires convincing these people to work for them. And they don't even have to use their mesmers, and they just have to be kind of a little flattering and, you know, laugh knowingly.
They just have to be cooler than these guys, and they lap it right up.
Yeah, when the guy refers to himself as Van Damme, you go, yeah, you're totally like Van Damme. Van Helsing? No, Van Hel. Oh, yeah, right, sure. Right. So it is entirely justified to have some level of idiot plotting in real-life spy stories. The problem with that is that players expect everybody to be really smart and on the ball, and their logic assumes that. So you have to introduce really early on, if you're going to import people like this into your spy mysteries, the idea that many spies are idiots and that they may well be doing completely stupid things. And you must also look at this question from the
logic. In Knights Black Agents terms, this is a classic level one opposition of the conspiramid. This is the bottom of the conspiramid. Maybe yeah. Marszalek is like level two, but those guys are supposed to be a little rough, a little easy to take out, because that's what gets you the in. So in the Knights Black Agents game, getting that guy's cell phone would then open you up to level two, and you'd be able to move up. And maybe it's Marszalek, maybe there's other people that you'd put clues on in the cell phone. And then, as I mentioned, we have this whole second group in Montenegro. If you want to lateral a move and go check those guys out, that's good fun.
Well, on that conclusive note, let's quickly head through this commercial and see what waits on the other side. In the spiral.
Four scenarios embrace the works and deaths of agents between 2016 and 2020, years called the Spiral and the Delta Green Campaign, God's Teeth.
That span of cruelty and corruption in American government seemed a bitter interregnum.
A momentary eruption of spite.
Now it stands revealed as a preparation for revelations to come.
In God's eye, a baffling disappearance leads the agents to confront the inexorable government panopticon.
They face unnatural revelations unleashed by the death of privacy.
And must survive desperate revenge beneath the sleepless skies.
In God's breath, a Delta Green friendly leaves a frantic voicemail about a Denver prisoner vomiting up an alien worm.
Your agents must identify the unnatural threat.
Trace it to its source.
Burn it out.
Just be careful of the smoke.
In God's law, a shockingly gruesome death leads the agents to a Los Angeles police gang.
It has twisted older, deeper laws towards the tired avarice of corruption.
How far do the agents go to resist the unnatural?
In God's light, the wreckage left by a mass shooter catches Delta Green's attention.
Somehow behind it, a surprising app that reaches strange places on the border between worlds.
The scenarios of God's Hunt are playable with Arc Dream Publishing's Delta Green, the role-playing game.
Play the scenarios on their own, as a cycle, or as a perfect companion to the acclaimed campaign Delta Green, God's Teeth.
Learn more about Delta Green at delta-green.com.
Immunize this podcast from the death touch of underfinancing by joining such beloved Patreon backers as
Ryan Mannix,
Scott Jones,
The Molten Sulfur Blog,
Ariel Celeste,
and Ginge.
The chatter of the Selectric typewriter, the gurgle of mid-priced bourbon going into the glass, and the fact that the dictionary on the table is open to irony welcome us to How to Write Good, the most inconvenient of huts to introduce grammatically. And also, ironically, in How to Write Good, we're talking about what happens when you've overshot your word count, as we may have already done in this very podcast, but forward is the only way through.
Yes, the time count is a whole different segment. So yeah, we want to look at strategies for cutting when you overshot your word count. This is if you are especially beginning as a role-playing writer, that is the issue you are most likely to have. The chances of your writing too much are greater than the chances of your writing too little. And what do you do? That's the one job that the developer is just going to bounce it back to, right? If you were supposed to write 7,500 words, you've submit 9,000, your developer is just going to say, yeah, resubmit it at the proper length. You've got to solve this. They're not going to cut that material for you. You got to do it. It's hard. It's painful. So we're here to help with ideas of where to start looking. And appropriately, the first place to look for words that you can cut is your introduction, because this is almost invariably where you begin to type into the blank screen, and you're revving your thoughts up, and you're sort of structuring the piece in your mind. And the chances of your writing stuff in the introduction that you can go back and take out are very high indeed. So that's a place that you can easily condense. Also, if you have a section that explains the whole backstory of the adventure that is not itself directly player facing, you very likely have written more information than the GM needs to assimilate. They probably need a few little basics, a few little bullet points, and chances are that you can heavily condense that section as well and pull it back to its bare bones. And before I throw it over to you for some other suggestions, Ken, I'm going to mention another really obvious one, which is unneeded standard reminders. Wherever you say, like at the beginning, don't read this adventure if you're a player, you can take that as read. You can cut that bit. Wherever you say, but remember, you as game master can always do something different than I've told you to do. Again, completely implicit. You don't need to keep reminding them about rule zero. Some writers have a real sort of mannerism about that. And if you do that, the good news is you can now cut it and get your word count down. And also, you do not need to, unless instructed to do so, for example, if it's a tutorial, reiterate basic rules or ideas of the core rule set. You can assume that the GM has the core rule set. They don't need you to repeat any of it. So Ken, back in the day when you wrote too long, how would you go about cutting things?
Well, first of all, Robin, every one of my words is perfect. And why would it want to be cut? Obviously, the job of the graphic designer is to make my words work. But
that's what makes it all the more painful to cut it.
Often, as you say, there will be a thing that is fun. So much of what I do specifically in a scenario or in a game is the research, is the part that underlies the scenario. And there are things that go into a scenario that are arguably secondary in terms of making the scenario go, and or in terms of a source book, making the source book go. And a lot of it is just, you know, killing your darlings. And in my case, the darling is this cool bit of research that I found that a GM who is like me would immediately know how to use and be able to use, but a more sort of conventional, regular, effective GM would find a distraction. And so the key for me anyway is to go through and say, what is in here solely because I like it? And what is in here because it actually, for the modal GM, will make the game richer or better or faster or stronger? And sometimes, I do not say every time, but sometimes I can spot the difference between those and regretfully remove a cool sidebar or even a whole scene that exists only to introduce this neat bit about the setting or the background or whatever, or this cool thing that I've thought of. But if it's usually with fiction, with straight fiction, you know, I can cut that to size in my head, and then cutting word count really involves just going through and doing more line reading where it's, you know, did I say seems? Take that out. Everything seems, you know, your very standard sort of cuts, which I suppose we will get to anon in this segment.
Right. And so basically, if you're writing a source book, you may find an easy out is just to look at all your headers and go, of these headers, which two are the least essential? Mm-hmm. If you're lucky, you can maybe put them on the web as web content. And, you know, at Pelgrane, you can even like get paid for that. But that's the quick and easy way. In a scenario, it's tougher. A thing that I would direct you to look at for condensing a scenario is narrative chunks where you are describing things in a sort of an authorial voice to the GM. Chances are that your scenario format does not include box text. If it does, even there, you should be condensing that into two or three sentences into a basic few images. And it's easiest to overwrite that sort of material, and therefore, fortunately, if painful, easier to cut it. Also, your scenario may include sort of flourishes that are kind of aimed at the GM. They aren't even aimed at the player. And it's like, and here's where the horror really begins, or, you know, sort of hyping the story, sort of selling them the story. They've already bought in. They're reading the scenario. You can cut all that stuff. And the equivalent in a scenario of the header that you can remove in a sourcebook section is the unlikely alt scene, right? That you possibly even in response to playtest feedback or something happened when you ran it, you've included, you know, well, what happens if they go out to the shed and they find the bugs? What happens then? And you may very well need that because they might go to the shed to look at the bugs, but you can present that in a condensed format that's more sort of instructions to the GM than a fully narrated scene, because you think that most groups won't do that or that it won't be the most fun thing. So basically, look at how much playtime at the table is going to come out of your section for the average group and be ruthless accordingly as you look at that material. And as you mentioned, Ken, the final last resort, the most horrible, but also the most necessary and rewarding thing, and the thing that will make people think that you're a really skilled writer, is to tighten up individual sentences. And so there are all sorts of ways to do that. They're not best described verbally, but I'll give you some examples of how to do that. So for example, sentences with of the in them, sometimes you need that connective tissue, particularly if you want to place a certain word at the end of a sentence. Sometimes if you're going for an old-timey rhythm, you need it, but very often you can cut instances of the, and certainly if you have a sentence that has more than one, you want to cut them down to one. So for example, you may have a mannerism where you go, some of the members go off and do X. Well, you just say some members go off and do X. The next level of removing of those is to move the words around a bit. So instead of squirrels of the New York area, you swap that around to New York area squirrels. And quite often that not only cuts your word count, but it gives you a more energetic, more muscular prose style. Also look out for different things that make your syntax more complicated and find ways to shorten and simplify it. For example, things being done by people can very often be just turned around. So for example, your sentence says, the agents are recruited by Stephanie Jones. You say, Stephanie Jones recruits the agents.
Yeah. Removing passive voice has all manner of advantages. Among them, it makes things shorter.
Yes, exactly. And also, you will find that if you use other weak or inactive verbs, is, are, be, those are not always necessarily technically passive, but they're always inactive. And by moving a more active word into the verb slot, you can also usually cut that as well. So there's a couple of benefits from that. And then finally, as you get used to editing your work, learn where you tend to put the fat in your sentences. So I, for example, when I write a first draft, will often have a kind of redundant clause as my final clause of the sentence. So I always take an extra little look at the end of every sentence, because that's, if there's a chunk that is redundant, is unnecessary, that repeats the information, that continues to reiterate, you can just cut, in that case, all four of those clauses.
And you can usually spot, for example, one of my habits is to give three examples of something when I'm, whatever it is that would have a list of examples or some examples. I try to give three just because that I think gives a broader, you know, base for the GM to extrapolate from. But three examples takes up, you know, three word count, two examples takes up two word count and is not that much worse. So if you have, even it's not necessarily a redundant thing, but it's an extra thing, you can take it out. If you've got, you know, lots of bad things that your villain has done, you know, look for the highlight bad things and, you know, cut out the, you know, cruel to his mom on her birthday part, take that out and leave in the rapine and the savaging as the sort of thing the scenario is about.
Right. Also look for parentheticals, things in brackets. They are, at the very least, very often a sign of a disordered syntax in which you...
They're literally parenthetical.
Yeah. And so sometimes you need them, sometimes you have to leave them in, but a lot of the time they're the less important part of the sentence and you can just cut them. Often you will write those in and you'll also write in, you know, but on the other hand, the elves are sometimes merry, because in your head, you're hearing a player go, yeah, well, what about this other situation?
Hashtag well, not all
you
don't elves.
Have to, yeah, you have to, not every time do you have to account for every possibility. And,
right.
And when you need to find room, that's the time to cut out some of those exceptions and contradictions along with the other digressions. And lest we digress any further, let's digress all the way, Ken, into another hot Andor segment.
Thank you.
December 5th, 1775. A wagon train led by bookseller-turned-artillery officer Henry Knox arrives at Fort Ticonderoga in upstate New York.
His goal, haul captured British cannons through the snowy mountains to the siege of Boston and drive the Redcoats from the cradle of liberty.
This year, Henry Knox's noble train of artillery delivers presents not to General Washington, but to you!
In Flagbearer Games' exciting Revolutionary War role-playing game, Nations and Cannons.
Visit nationsandcannons.com and use promo code CANNON at checkout for 17.75% off and free PDFs of your books. Time once more to wend our way up the creepity cobweb stairs. We're going to stop on the landing and wave to the portrait of the King of the Fire Salamanders. He's going to give us a little elemental wink, and we're going to head on in to the parlor of the consulting occultist. And this time around, he's wearing a uniform and smoking a corncob pipe because he's here to tell us about Douglas MacArthur. But wait, in the consulting occultist? Yes, indeed, because we're going to talk about Douglas MacArthur as the recipient of Korean shamanic worship. Ken, let's talk about the MacArthur before he passed into the watery spirit realm.
Douglas MacArthur was the commanding general in the Pacific during World War II, was put in charge of the occupation of Japan. At that point, while he was running Japan, the North Koreans invaded South Korea. And the Russians, for whatever reason, known only to them, did not veto the UN resolution to counter that aggression with force. The UN asks the Americans to run things. The Americans put MacArthur in charge. So he leads the UN forces, including the South Korean army, in the fighting retreat to Busan. And then the Incheon landing in 1950 breaks the back of the North Korean logistics. He's able to rapidly liberate South Korea, and then, while moving to liberate North Korea, attracts the Chinese communist armies, which pour over the Yalu River and begin attacking him. He and Truman have a public disagreement about how best to handle this incursion by the Chinese. MacArthur suggests maybe some A-bombs would be nice. Truman says, "You're fired." And that is the end of the MacArthur story as far as Korea goes. He goes on to be sort of a cranky figure, former general, annoying president of the sort we've had in the democracy forever. He dies in 1968. And as you say, goes on to the watery spirit realm. I suppose it is relevant in this disquisition to say he was a master of public relations and manipulating his own image. He was certainly the kind of guy who, if the spirit realm is looking for shiny, brightly colored figures to adopt, he has made himself a target of such energies. I would argue that.
Right. With ready accessories like his pipe and
exactly,
his sunglasses.
The whole nine yards.
To make it easy to portray him.
And in this specific case, the people who adopt him are the Mudongs, which are what these practitioners of Mu, meaning the sort of magic or strange activity. It's the Korean version of Wu from China. So there we are. And they're often translated as shamans, although they do not engage in ecstatic trance journeys, which many people say is the sine qua non of shamanism. Anyway, they practice or believe a system called Musak, which is from the words Mu folklore. This was a derogatory term used during the Japanese occupation, but now it's been reclaimed by the Mudongs, along with Misin, which means superstition, for the general body of lore and practices that they practice Musak within. And that includes geomancy, divination, spirit communication, a lot of things that show up in shamanic culture, certainly, but also show up in things like voodoo or other Afro-Caribbean religions that are about specific communication and interaction with spirits, and including spiritualism, in fact.
And if you keep up with Korean horror cinema, you've probably seen Mudangs in action in movies like The Wailing or Exuma, which both of us love.
Yeah.
So this may be familiar to you from that. It's now a common staple element of horror films.
Some scholars, and these include Korean folklorists who are eagerly claiming that Korean culture is older than Chinese or Japanese culture, so take this with a grain, goes back to 1000 BC. The key parts of Musak are not mentioned in Korean print until 1145 or so AD, but this includes the ritual, which is called Gut, and magic images, which are called Sinhwa, religious spirit images. It is banned by the Confucians of the Joseon. They persecute Mudongs. They're forbidden from being even in Seoul or Pyongyang, any of the capitals. They're driven out. Then the Japanese occupiers ban it because they say, oh, this is primitive Korean dirt worship. We're cool moderns. So the Korean resistance to Japan, half of it is very modernizing and also doesn't like it. North Korea, of course, bans it because it's magic, not materialism. And it is banned or very much discouraged by the South Korean government for, as I say, wanting, considering it pre-modern and non-relevant in the 20th century. And this goes on with one or another degree of official persecution until 1979, when President Park is assassinated and Korea sort of moves into a more democratic situation. The Mudongs under Park responded to their banning or their government discouragement by forming what they called the Korean Victory Over Communism Federation of Shamans, which is, speaking of branding, how can you be against the victory over communism? What is wrong with you? I thought we were on the same side.
I hope the acronym is super cool right. In Korean. I really hope it's like SHIELD or something.
It probably also spells SHIELD in Korean. So anyway, Musak can either just involve straight up mediumship. You're talking to the spirits. They're talking back to you. Maybe you do voices, whatever. Or you can be possessed by the beings called the Gui Sin, which are anything from local ghosts all the way up to levels of divinity. And again, this is very similar to voodoo, where the Loa can be anything from, you know, practically gods down to your granddad. And the divinities are technically called the Jangun Sin. There are some lesser divinities who are all generals. These are called the generals, and they're known as the Sin Jong. And if you're embodying a Sin Jong, often you use what are called Jakdu blades, which are ceremonial knives. And there's a whole sort of knife act that you work up. You can, you know, eat the knife or stab yourself with a knife or cut yourself with a knife, and you're not harmed because you're full of Sin Jong energy. And this performance is called Jakdu Jori. And one of the theories is that this sort of performance, maybe it comes out of legitimate village traditions of there's nothing to watch, let's go watch the Mudong do something. Or maybe it comes from straight up the same place that Western spiritualism comes from, stage magic. So who can say? And what is the difference at this point? So anyway, the Mudongs around Incheon specifically added MacArthur to the pantheon of Sinjong in the 1970s, basically to signal that they were pro-American and therefore pro-democracy. And also, hey, victory over communism. Who's more victorious over communism than MacArthur? We ask you. And so it's really good, branding. And you live in Incheon, you've got a bunch of statues of MacArthur everywhere. So straight up psychometry or geomancy will tell you MacArthur has got a real position in the land, and you have to be able to talk to him to get anything done.
Right. And speaking of the land, the particular group of shamans who started, including MacArthur, come from North Korea. They come from the adjacent Hwanghae region in North Korea. And so there's also an anti-North element to invoking him. And their choice of Incheon was just, it's the nearest place to get to once you escape the North. But of course, it's incredibly symbolic of the site of his victory. Mm-hmm. And if you live in a city of war memorials, that creates a symbology that infects things and makes things more powerful. And the Hwanghae region particularly emphasizes those warrior helper spirits. So it's quite natural for them to cast around for a warrior to look to. And so that creates his watery connection to that area. A lot of the details that I'm throwing in are from a article from the Journal of Korean Religions by Hyunik Kwon and Junhwan Park. And the paper is called American Power in Korean Shamanism. And so I want to make sure that they get a little shout out right. Because there's so much cool stuff that they have found, including the fact that if you look at a lot of other sources, they will imply that the MacArthur thing was a brief thing in the 70s. But nope, it's still perfectly active.
Still going. It's just regional, right? It's artisanal.
Yeah.
So one big part of Musak is that you have sacred paintings that called Musindo or Sinhwa, and they depict the Gui Sin, but the painting is also channeled by the Mudong. So the Mudong has to go to a painter and say he's tall, but not super tall, and he's got curly hair and whatever their vision of the spirit is, because it has to match your vision for your ritual to work. If it's just like a portrait of MacArthur you downloaded off Wikipedia, that's not a spirit vision MacArthur. That's just regular MacArthur. And you might have that around, but your sacred painting has to be the vision of MacArthur that you have. So one MacArthur Sinhua may not look like his statue or like his encyclopedia entry or like any other MacArthur Sinhua, except for the sort of, you know, code features such as sunglasses, corncob pipe, and cool hat.
Right. And in some of the paintings, he's standing alongside another warrior helper spirit, the genius 16th century naval commander Yi Sun Sin, who you may know, again, if you're a Korean cinema fan, from the recent Bafo box office trilogy, The Admiral Roaring Currents, Han San Rising Dragon, and Noryang Deadly Sea. And the two of them are invoked along with a 16th century general, Im Young Up, in one introductory invocation. So they're not just pictured in the paintings, but they are mentioned in the invocations as sort of an idea of, you know, uniting the powers of different warrior helper spirits to tackle whatever problem the rite is meant to address. Sometimes the rites use the U.S. flag and sometimes the South Korean flag.
Yeah, much as in voodoo, where you have the drogues, the magic flags, or the vever, the magic symbol, got an American flag. What's a better way to get MacArthur's attention, I ask you? I guess maybe a Harry Truman bobblehead doll would also get his attention, but not in a good way. So the ritual that of communing with a spirit, either by speaking or by possession, is called a gut. That's a whole thing as well. When you're communing with a spirit, you wear sinbok, which are magic clothes, and these attract the spirit, and the clothes are specific, so you have to change clothes if you're doing different spirits over the course of a single gut, which you often are. And of course, if you're a Mudong communing with MacArthur, you wear a U.S. Army hat, you wear the sunglasses, you smoke the corncob pipe, and that puts you sort of, you know, you're tuning your carrier wave to MacArthur's frequency. And then with your Sinhua painting, you can channel the version of MacArthur, the facet of MacArthur that has been speaking to you. And then one presumes he says, get victorious over communism. Stop laying around.
His frequency is powerful because there's other cultures that also magically venerate MacArthur. The Kuna people of Panama include MacArthur amulets, or in one case, a statue, among their images of gringos, which is part of their healing and divinatory practice. And the idea there is just that gringos are powerful. We're going to take their power and use it to predict the future or to cure someone who is ill. And the odd thing about that is that MacArthur was only very briefly stationed in Panama for a couple of months in 1912, and it's an unremarkable short stint. I suspect maybe we've hit on the thing is that he's, as American generals go, he's got props that make him identifiable, right? It's easier to do a MacArthur statue than it is to do an Eisenhower statue or, you know, or a Stormin Norman Schwarzkopf.
Right. Or a Patton statue, because then you have to get a silver-handled pistol.
Yeah. The Biak of Indonesia also include MacArthur among their figurative symbols of the big foreigners, who, again, are you're summoning the political power of foreigners and turning it into magic. So once MacArthur became a water spirit, he really expanded his remit.
And if we had had more time, it would have been interesting, and maybe we'll look into it, but maybe not. What about the Philippines? Of course, that's the, you know, island chain that he was most famously associated with. That's where he promised to return to. I'm wondering, in the Philippines, is there a similar tradition of village worship that attaches to MacArthur, or are they all still mad at him for leaving in the first place? I don't know, but it would be fun to find out what the local Philippine version of Musak has to say about MacArthur. Possibly nothing nice. Maybe they're all pro-Truman shamans.
Right. Or maybe there's a powerful wall of Catholicism keeping out the watery MacArthur.
Exactly.
So that's a detail that you can borrow when the player characters go to South Korea to find stuff out. MacArthur might be willing to help fellow Americans if they're American characters. But
it's only if they want to be victorious over communism, not lacking Americans who don't want to A-bomb the Chinese.
Well, yeah, you might want to not fully take every piece of advice he gives you, and definitely don't give him the nuclear football.
Do not. That is a bad idea. Do not give the spirit of MacArthur the nuclear codes. I cannot emphasize this enough.
Right. Well, we could gamify things further, but I think we should stop on that very important piece of advice, which everyone should take to heart. And we'll be back with more similar nonsense a week from today. Stuff having once again been talked about, it's time to thank our sponsors.
Atlas Games.
Palgrain Press.
Arc Dream.
Flagbearer Games.
Dork Tower.
And Pro Fantasy Software.
Music, as always, is by James Semple.
Audio editing by Rob Borges.
Support our Patreon at patreon.com/KenAndRobin.
Ensure that this podcast is cut judiciously, not permanently, by joining such backers as
Jeffrey Pittman,
Chris Lydon,
Chihiro Yamada,
Garrett Fitzgerald,
and Hyperlexic.
Wear this show or drink it from a mug with Ken and Robin merch at kenrobin.dashery.com.
Celebrate your joy of missing out with our latest design, Jomo.
On X, he's at Kenneth Height.
And on Blue Sky, he's robindlaws.bisky.social.
See you next time when, once again, we will talk about stuff.